Hey, this is Jonathan Goodman, and I have incredibly exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, is now available for purchase in Kindle, in Audible, and in hardcover. Anywhere that you find books, please go on Amazon, please go to whatever bookstore you like, buy yourself a copy, buy a copy for a friend. Hope that you absolutely love it. Now let's get into the show.
The obvious choice really is you. I mean, the obvious choice has a number of meanings, right? The obvious choice is you and how you can become the obvious choice for your customers. I mean, that's the most obvious meaning, is that it's far better and profitable and simpler and easier for you to be the obvious choice to a less amount of people, to a fewer amount of people, than it is for you to be a just good or just okay choice to a lot of people. You know, I'll give you an example. It's like, what do you think is more profitable? What do you think is better, is to have, call it 10,000 people who are tangentially interested in fitness listen to your podcast, or to have 50 people who are high net worth, well-connected, who all live within a 5-mile radius of you listen to your podcast? Like, what do you think is actually going to be better for your business? You know, you're the good choice in a very, very bloody, noisy sea of people who kind of talk about fitness stuff in the first one, where you may have more folks, but none of them, you're the obvious person that they're going to hire for anything. You just maybe hooked them with a headline or had a guest on or whatever that they were interested in. The second one is people who feel like they have, and number one, you've pre-selected them to be the right kind of customer, but also there are people who feel like they have some sort of connection to you, to the point where you're the obvious choice. You know, we share 99%+ of our DNA with every other human being on the planet. And so it's not the 99% that makes you the same that's going to make you stand out. It's the 1% that makes you different. And so what is that uncommon commonality that you have? I call it your geek flag. You know, how do you, what's your geek flag? How do you let your geek flag fly high? What do you have in common with somebody else that is also uncommon for them that they have in common with you, for example? And it could be where you live, right? It could be that they just happen to share a neighborhood with you. Where you raise your family is a very important thing. I trust other people who live on the same street as me, even if I don't know them, because we've made the decision to raise our family in the same place. There's a lot of trust involved there. And so if they were to recommend, or even if like somebody was making a delivery to their house, for example, I would trust that company making that delivery more than anybody anywhere online. Simply because one of my neighbors, who I don't even know them, has decided to buy, you know, that company. It could also be like a shared religious affiliation, you know, somebody in a church with you. It could also be like a shared hobby. You know, I wear a Casio F91W watch. I think it's the best watch in the planet. Well, I've actually built a lot of good connections with people just because I've spoken on the internet about how much I love this watch and how I think that this is the watch that everybody should wear because it's the perfect watch. And I talk about why that is. But also, I kind of poke fun at it. You know, every time that Bitcoin jumps up in price, I measure the price of Bitcoin on a new measurement that I developed called CSIO, which is the amount of Casio watches you can buy per Bitcoin. And so right now, for example, you can buy 10,365 Casio watches per Bitcoin. And so that's kind of become a joke within my community. I get people, anytime Bitcoin jumps up, I get people, somebody did it yesterday. I get people posting on my wall. They're like, hey man, how many Casios can I get? Like what's the CSIO ratio right now? Somebody put up, there was a staff writer for The Atlantic, you know, big publication, wrote an article. I didn't know who this was. His name's Ross Anderson, but I didn't know who he was. And he wrote an article about why the Casio watch is the perfect watch. Yo, I had that article sent to me by at least 50 people. Casio came out with this ring that's like a really ugly Casio watch that's a ring that's like a whatever, steps counter and stuff as well. I must have had that thing sent to me by over 100 people. What is that uncommon commonality that's kind of weird about you and different? Can you actually talk about that? Can you lead with that? Because then other people wearing a Casio watch look down at it and they remember you and they think about you. You know, another one with me is I have an unhealthy obsession with totally worthless Ken Griffey Jr. baseball cards. I've got like 900 unique Ken Griffey Jr. baseball cards. None of them are worth anything. Like nothing. Like I don't have any valuable ones. It's not true. I have one 1989 Upper Deck that is maybe worth like $80. Beyond that, I have no valuable Ken Griffey Jr. cards. But I've built relationships with people in my community that's much tighter relationship because I talk about this. Now, there's something that I heard Tim Ferriss say a lot of years ago. And this is back when Tim was just like a lowly blogger like the rest of us. And he put out this article, he had a very, very popular blog back in the day, right? And he put out this article that talked about basically how to have a great blog. And I actually think it was a great piece of advice for how to stand out anywhere you are. And the advice is you want to write something that 90% of your audience doesn't care about, but 10% of your audience very uniquely will love. What most people do is they try to write something that 80% of people kind of like. And as a result, when you do that, what's happening is, yeah, sure, a lot of people are kind of liking it. You might get comments, you might get more people sharing it, but you don't become the obvious choice to anybody specifically because kind of by definition, you're writing the same type of thing, the same type of way, or producing the same type of thing, the same type of way as anybody else can. When you are writing or producing content that is so comically niche specific, like instead of just saying that here's a great workout for training new glutes, okay, who cares? Here's a great workout for training new glutes for moms, okay, who cares? Here's a great workout for training new glutes for postpartum mothers, okay, who cares? Here's a great workout for training your glutes for postpartum mothers who have had a C-section, who are army wives, currently living on base. Holy shit, now you got something, right? Most people looking at that will gloss past it, but think about what happens then. Now you have a vision with your content, right? I always say vision is like reading Twitter your entire life and then one day discovering that there's such a thing as books. Once you go that tight, you can actually work backwards. Now you know exactly where your people are. You know the movers and shakers in those worlds. You know where they exist. You know where to access them. You know where to talk to them. You can actually get on the phone and learn about them and find out like their unique needs and their frustrations and maybe what facilities or access they have or whatever. You know what language matters to them. And kind of by definition, what you've done is you built a program that so uniquely serves them in a way that nobody else would ever do. This is how you start. This is how you grow from nothing. And what's interesting about this is what every single person says whenever I give an example like that C-section example or whatever it is they're like, yeah, but that means that so many other people won't be able to buy from me. You know, I'm turning them away. It's like, yeah, exactly. That's the point. First of all, somebody who doesn't live on an army base that is postpartum, you could still help them. So it doesn't mean you turn away customers. But if you try to be for everybody, you are for nobody. And this is the same whether you have aspirations to one day become huge or whether you have aspirations that are perhaps a little bit more small and you know, you just want to make a difference in your own community, whether that community is local to you or whether the community is online. Peter Thiel is, you know, first investor to Facebook, wrote a book, Zero to One, one of the most notable, I guess, like Silicon Valley investors. He's a billionaire. You know what his number one piece of advice is? His number one piece of advice when you build a company is to turn it into a monopoly as early as possible. Thiel says, the way to gain a monopoly as early as possible is to figure out the smallest available market that you can monopolize and then go and monopolize it. And then perhaps over time, expand and monopolize adjacent markets. The biggest companies in the world followed this. You just don't see it because it was so far in the past. PayPal started with 30,000 eBay power sellers, built a solution for them. Facebook started on the Harvard campus. Nike started with Phil Knight selling running shoes out of the back of his Plymouth Valiant at local track meets. Because what did they all intuitively understand, whether they knew what they were doing or not doing at that time, was they knew that there was no way that they could compete if playing the same game as the incumbents. Like, how do you beat Michael Jordan? You don't play basketball. You play a game that you can win. And the game that you can win is the game that the larger incumbents, the people who have more money and more brand and better efficiency because they've been around for a long time, the game that they are unwilling and or unable to play. You go much smaller, you go much tighter. And then as you gain more resources, as you make more sales, as you start to build yourself up, you can begin to expand out. Daniel Breeze is an example that I like, and I give in the book. I might get the specifics of the story wrong, but Daniel Breeze is an accountant, okay? And he first worked as an accountant at like some accountant firm, as some staff accountant, and then he went and took a counsel job. I think it was at a beauty company as like their financial person. And then, but he still had a couple private clients on the side that he was doing accounting for, and he got a client who was a high-ticket coach, fitness coach in Ontario. And he helped this person do what a good accountant will help them do. This coach sold in US dollars, lived in Ontario in Canada. He helped them figure out how to convert their US dollars to Canadian dollars at a more favorable rate than the ripoff rate that the banks give. He helped them manage their taxes better. He helped them figure out where to charge tax, where not to charge tax. All of these questions, and he saved this person that he was working with thousands of dollars. This person then introduced Daniel to his business coach. This business coach said, hey, this is great. Daniel, why don't you give a presentation? Daniel started taking on more high-ticket fitness coaches who live in Ontario who sell to mostly American customers. It did not take long for Daniel to become the obvious choice to a tiny market, right? High-ticket business coaches who live in Ontario, who sell to Americans in US dollars. You would be hard pressed to find a smaller market, but you know what? There's enough of them and they're highly connected and you can provide extreme value to them. They have very specific needs that you understand and they all know each other and they'll all recommend you. Within 6 months, Daniel quit his job at the beauty company. His entire business at that point was a Google form that people filled out. That was his entire business. No social media, no website. Super profitable. And then you contrast that with other accounting firms. And what I like about that story is like Daniel does not do anything different than what a great accountant at a big accounting firm would also do. But there's something that Roy Sutherland, who's the VP in the behavior change unit at Ogilvy, says in the UK. He goes, it's the jack of all trades fallacy. Something that does one thing we value more than something that does one thing and any other thing. I'll say that again. We value something that does one thing higher than we value something that does that same one thing and any other thing. Daniel was valued because he's the obvious choice and he branded himself as the accountant for high-ticket online fitness coaches in Ontario who sell to American customers. He does not do anything different than a good accountant at a large accountant firm will do. But the reason why Daniel's the obvious choice and that other accountant isn't to this small audience is because the other accountant also works with gyms. The other accountant also works with lawyers. The other accountant also works with construction workers. They might do an equally good job with all of these audiences, but they're not the obvious choice to any of them. As a result, their job is considerably harder in terms of acquiring customers. They don't really know where to go. It's harder to integrate into these networks. They're not going to get referred the same kind of way that Daniel's. Daniel, meanwhile, has been able to get more than enough market share to make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year at a crazy profitable rate. I mean, imagine like a service business like being an accountant where all your entire marketing is you have a free Google form. What's his profitability, you think? I don't know the answer, but I would say probably upwards of 80%. I mean, what's his expenses? He basically needs to pay to accept money. That's like his expense. You know, maybe he has some software that he runs as his accountant. And then he's got his certification for being an accountant that he's got to upkeep. Like his profitability has got to be insane. And so there's a lot of problems in business, especially when you're early on, that you can solve with excess profit, with lots of money. There are very few problems that you can't. And so what's Daniel done now is now Daniel is starting to expand in an adjacent way. Now he's an accountant for high-ticket coaches, not just fitness coaches, who live in Ontario, who sell to mostly online customers. You see how this works? You can start to expand to adjacent as you gain more resources, as you gain more stability over time. But you start as tight as possible and you monopolize what I call SAM, the smallest available market, as early as possible. And then you can decide or not decide, depending on your own aspirations, what direction you want to go in. Some people decide that, yo, I'm good. right? Like, this is great. And I give lots of examples of that in The Obvious Choice in the book. Like, the mistake, though, is that if you enter in a market in a fear-based way, thinking that you need to appeal to everybody, what happens is that you actually uniquely appeal to nobody. And so your cost per acquisition per customer is way higher if you even get a customer. Your differentiation is so much lower that you can't, by definition, charge higher prices, which means your profitability is going to be shrunk way more, which means you're going to continually just be painted more and more and more into a corner, forced into a reactive, not proactive state in your business early on, which creates this death spiral downwards, which eventually puts you out of business, actually pretty quickly puts you out of business.